Quote from Alice Miller, causing a child to feel shame can also be a stratagem in the struggle against willfulness, i.e. possessing a will of one's own, which is their motive, their mission in life, to destroy in the child's will. And she quotes now a poisoned pedagogue. As already outlined above, willfulness must be broken at an early age by making the child feel the adult's unquestionable superiority. Later on, shaming the child has a more lasting effect, especially on vigorous natures, for whom willfulness is often allied with boldness and energy. Toward the end of his education, either a veiled or an open reference to the ugly and immoral character of this fault must succeed in enlisting the child's thoughts and all his willpower against the last vestiges of willfulness. It has been our experience that a private conversation proves efficacious in this last stage. In view of the prevalence of willfulness in children, it's very surprising that the appearance, nature, and cure of this antisocial psychic phenomenon has received so little attention and elucidation in child psychology and pathology. Unquote from Grunewald on the character fault of willfulness in children. Alice replies, "It's always important to the power mad," says Alice, "to employ all these methods as early as possible." Quote from the poisoned pedagogue, "If we frequently do not achieve our purpose, even in this manner, let this be a reminder for wise parents to make their child docile, malleable, and obedient at a very early age, and to accustom him to conquer his own will. This is a major aspect of moral education, and to neglect it is the worst mistake we can make. The correct observance of this duty, without jeopardizing the other duty that obligates us to see that the child is kept in a happy frame of mind, is the most important skill required in early training," unquote from Bach. And Alice replies, in the three scenes, in the scenes that follow, because we're not going to read all of them, we see vivid examples of how the principles described above can be put into practice. I quote these passages at length in order to give the reader an idea of the atmosphere these children, i.e. if not we ourselves, then at least our parents, breathed in daily. And, I toyed with taking the time to read it all. It is very lengthy, and the length of it does provide this suffocating atmosphere. I guess I was afraid I'd drive you all away. Anyway, she says, this material helps us to understand how neuroses develop. They are not caused by an external event, but by repression of the innumerable psychological factors making up the child's daily life that the child is never capable of describing, because he or she doesn't know that these things can be any other way. And my comment, isn't it eerie how closely the suppression of our thought corresponds to what was done to the statesmen as infants? Quote from our poisoned pedagogue, until the time he was four, I taught little Conrad four essentials: to pay attention, to obey, to behave himself, and to be moderate in his desires. The first I accomplished by continually showing him all kinds of animals, flowers, and other wonders of nature, and by explaining pictures to him. The second, by constantly making him, whenever he was in my presence, do things at my bidding. The third, by inviting children to come play with him from time to time when I was present, and whenever a quarrel arose, I determined who had started it and removed the culprit from the game for a time. And fourth, I taught him by often denying him something he asked for with great agitation. Once, for example, I cut up a honeycomb and brought a large dishful into the room. Honey, he cried joyfully. Father, give me some honey. Pulled his chair to the table, sat down, and waited for me to spread a few rolls with honey for him. And recall, Conrad is four or less. I didn't do it, but I set the honey before him and said, I'm not going to give you honey yet. First, we'll plant some peas in the garden. Then, when that's done, we'll enjoy a roll with honey together. Conrad looked first at me, then at the honey, whereupon he went to the garden with me. Also, when serving food, I always arranged it so that he was the last one served. In the next story, and that's a unquote from Salzman, in the next story, Alice says, in which telling a lie is the only possible way for the child to read in privacy. Quote, a lie is something dishonorable, says our poisoned pedagogue. It is recognized as such even by those who tell one. And there probably isn't a single liar who has any self-respect. And please keep in mind as I read this shortened version of this story of little Katie, that she's trying to read in privacy. This is why she lied. But someone who doesn't respect himself, says our poisoned pedagogue, doesn't respect others either. And the liar thus finds himself excluded from human society to a certain extent. It follows from this that a young liar needs to be treated very discreetly so that in the process of being cured of his fault, his self-respect, which has already suffered, as it is from knowing he has lied, will not be even more seriously damaged. And this is no doubt a rule that admits of no exception. A child who lies must never be publicly censured or punished for this fault, or except under the most extreme circumstances, even publicly reminded of it. The adult will do well to appear to be more surprised and even astonished that the child has been untruthful than to appear outraged that he has told a lie. And the adult should pretend as long as possible. And note, the whole notion of this performance of the parent for the child is one massive lie, which it doesn't seem to have occurred to our poisoned pedagogue. And the adult, continuing, and the adult should pretend as long as possible that he takes a deliberate lie for an unintentional untruth. This is the key to the behavior assumed by Mr. Willick when he discovered traces of this vice, even in his own little family group. Katie was guilty of being untruthful on occasion, and we are going to advance past much shaming, and then more shaming, and some further shaming. And after even more shaming, Katie sat down, crying and sobbing, to do hurriedly what she had omitted to do the day before. Hardly had she begun, however, when Mr. Willick entered the room with a grave and mournful expression and silently paced up and down. Willick, you are crying, Katie. What has happened to you? Oh, dear father, you already know what it is. Willick, I want to know from you, Katie, what has happened. Katie, hiding her face in her handkerchief. I told another lie. Willick, unhappy child, is it really impossible for you to master your frivolous ways? Katie's tears and heavy heart prevented her from answering. Willick, I shall not besiege you with much talk, dear daughter. You already know well enough that a lie is a disgraceful thing, and have noted also that at times when you don't collect your thoughts, a lie pops out. What is to be done? You must take action, and I'll lend you support as a friend. Let the present day be set to mourn over the mistake you made yesterday. The ribbons you put on today must be black. Go and do it before your sisters get up. Then when Katie returned, having done as she had been ordered, Mr. Willick continued, be comforted. You shall have in me a faithful source of support in your sorrow, so that you become more mindful of yourself. You are to come to my room every evening before you go to bed and enter into a notebook that I am going to prepare for this purpose, either today I told a lie, or today I did not tell a lie. You need not fear a reprimand from me, even if you have to enter something unpleasant. I hope that just the reminder of a lie you have told will protect you from this vice for many days at a time, so that I, too, may do something to help you throughout the day to have something good in the evening to enter into the book, rather than something bad. I forbid you from evening on, when you take the black ribbon out of your hair, to wear any ribbons in your hair. I forbid this for an indefinite period until the record you keep convinces me that your earnest behavior and your truthfulness have become so ingrained that in my judgment, a recurrence is no longer to be feared. If you reach that point, as I hope you will, then you will be able to choose for yourself which color hair ribbon you shall wear. And that is Hosinger from the Wertheim family, quoted in Poisoned in Rutsky Black Pedagogy.